Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
That's going. We'll put that there.
Megan, we can sit here or you can sit wherever you want to sit. Folks, we may. I'll
move my bag. We'll end up with Ross and Margaret and.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight on the. Where Ross Fitzgerald returns to the Sydney Institute. Gerry Connolly returns to the Sydney Institute as Mr. Colony, not as. Not as last time you were here, you were. Paul Keating on one occasion and Queen Elizabeth on the other.
Monica Lewinsky.
Oh no, it was in Monica Lewinsky, yeah. So, it's all very boring tonight, folks, and of course Margaret Fink for the first time. All of the three speakers tonight are in the book which Ross Fitzgerald and Lyndall Moore have edited, Growing Old Disgracefully, which is Janet Grundy from Books Etc. has got some copies there. Apparently Anne says to me, I'm becoming deeply grumpy and as a factor of old age, Anne and I are also in the book, and I owe someone an apology because someone rang up at 5:10 in the night. We had a function a while ago and said, could they book, and I said, can you ring back in the morning, but apparently they're ringing from Paris and I didn't know. So apologies for that. And as to why I'm in the book, I mean, the only way to shut Ross for sure up is to say yes, and so I'm in the book for that reason, also because I can't stand the late Jim Killen, and I've spoken, written about him in the book. But tonight, we're here to hear three other contributors, who I will introduce. Now, we lead off with Gerry Connolly, the noted comic act. We lead off with Ross Fitzgerald, the noted comic actor, but I'm getting confused.
You can read out his credits for me.
The well-known broadcaster, historian and political commentator, Professor Ross Fitzgerald, writes a regular column in The Australian each Monday. He reviews for the Sydney Morning Herald, The Weekend Australian and The Bulletin, and regularly appears on ABC Radio, and no more, on ABC Radio and other places, and he's got a chapter in this book. We're going to lead off with Ross, and then I'm going to interview Margaret Fink, independent film producer. Her world-acclaimed film, My Brilliant Career, was part of Australia's film renaissance in the 1970s. She will come second, and then Gerry Connolly.
Last.
It says here in the introduction...
Well, he had time to write mine.
Yes. He intends to be buried in his hometown of Theodore. But, Gerry, you've got to die first. And... he's best known for his characterisations of the late Sir Joe Bjelke-Petersen and the former Prime Minister Paul Keating and the present Queen of Australia Elizabeth II and on occasions Monica Lewinsky, but that was for adults only entertainment at the Sydney Institute on that occasion. So we lead off with Professor Fitzgerald, and then each speaker will go no more than 15 minutes, and we'll take questions and discussion and stumble into the night sometime before 10 o'clock. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Yes, thanks a million, Jared. As Jared mentioned, Growing Old Disgracefully, my wife and I, Lyndall Moore and myself, are contributing co-editors. And as if we didn't feel old enough already, 2 days ago on Monday, At Parliament House, Premier Morris Yemma launched the book to coincide with the 50th anniversary of Seniors Week. Yet one of the advantages of Lyndall and I both being seniors is that we can say what we like, which is precisely what we've done in the book. And I might be biased, but in my opinion, Lyndall's contribution, Becoming Invisible, is one of the funniest pieces in Growing Old Disgracefully. Of course, truth goes both ways. Apart from the fact that as each year rolls on, I more and more resemble an old dog, half deaf and a quarter blind, the state of my physique is not really improved, as a comedian friend remarked, by me eating like a man with two stomachs. Not surprisingly, other bits of the body to which I will not refer are sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly giving up the ghost. Then there is what appears to me at least to be emotional and mental deterioration. Recently I said to my brother-in-arms, Gerard Henderson, I think I'm becoming more neurotic, to which Gerard replied, that's scarcely possible. It will not come as any revelation to those people who know me, like Lyndall and Anne Henderson and Gerard, that Give is still not my middle name. One day in Brisbane, after I presented an acquaintance who just had a baby with a less than expensive gift, I inexplicably broke into tears. A mate of mine explained the situation thus. You were, he said, overwhelmed by your own sensitivity. Last weekend, Lyndall reminded me of a scathing review of my work, written by one of my many enemies from Queensland. This devastating attack concluded, quote, Ross Fitzgerald is one of Australia's most prolific yet least read authors. The sad fact is that in many ways Lyndall agreed. Yet at this Sydney Institute function here tonight, we hold a shy hope that Growing Old Disgracefully might buck the trend and be both well received and actually widely read. For Lyndall and I, it has been a joy to edit this book of 35 essays, whose contributors range in age from the 84-year-old Erskine-based communist Hal Alexander to my dear friend Jerry Connolly, who has just nudged the big 5-0 and who will be speaking shortly. Contributors to the book, the initials of which Lyndall pointed out to me spelt God, Growing Old Disgracefully. Contributors to the book include committed Christians like the Brisbane-based writer Phil Brown and the very distinguished chairperson of the State Paroling Authority, Ian Pike, as well as less certain believers, including noted film producer Jim McElroy, through to unambiguous atheists like myself and Lyndall and the marvellous Margaret Fink, who Gerard will interrogate soon. All of God's writers in their different ways demonstrate that being 50 and over is anything but easy. And that, to paraphrase the American playwright Lillian Hellman, older age is not for wimps. Intriguingly, a number of contributors confide that slowly or suddenly they woke up one morning and the realisation dawned that they were growing older, if not old. Yet when push comes to shove, all contributors to the book, including Anne and Gerard Henderson, manifestly value life itself and their part within it, while most, if not all, believe that in some ways, many of them unpredictable, life can get even better. Yet despite some signs of physical decline, most contributors reveal the presence in their lives of hope, trust, commitment, perseverance, good humour, and perhaps above all, the resilient capacity to cop whatever life dishes out in the twilight, or at least the second half or final quarter of their lives. But don't be mistaken, physical and mental signs are there indeed, in my own case often in spades. Part of my current angst concerns time and its passing, something I try to control by always carrying a diary. In it, I write a daily shopping list, people to meet, places to go, things to write, to do and to buy. Indeed, each year I go through at least two diaries, sometimes three. When, as happened once in London, I actually lost my diary, I was, to use that peculiar phrase, beside myself, and had to try and remember, as it happened quite unsuccessfully, all the entries for the rest of that year. So growing old is not something I'm dealing with all that well. One of the many suggestions made by self-appointed experts about how to cope with ageing is to deliberately not remember crucial dates. In my case, this is impossible. How can I forget my birthday, Christmas Day, or my wife Lyndall's, which is September the 11th, what most of the world now calls 9/11? Or how could I even forget our wedding anniversary, which appropriately enough is November the 5th, Guy Fawkes Day? Balanced against this is my chronic inability to remember names. A promising suggestion from Barry Humphreys is to associate each person's name with some other thing or object. Recently, on a board on which I served, I was introduced to a new member called Ia. As her name sounded like Ia, I decided to associate her name thus. Unfortunately, the next time we met, I asked, "And what do you think about this matter, Chin?" The best advice I've been given to cope with all this mental and physical deterioration, and indeed with most other life problems as well, comes from my policeman friend from the Gold Coast, Detective Sergeant David Isherwood, known as Davo, who simply says, "Mate, what else can you do but cop it?" All of this is aided by reminding myself of an old Russian proverb that I made up for one of my Grafton Everest novels, "All that trembles does not fall." Another Queensland friend maintains that the cleverest and most brilliant idea that I've ever come up with is that shortly before I eat a meal at home, I turn my cardigan or my jumper inside out. It's true. It is true, actually. This means that whatever food drops down on me, including all the dribbles and stains, will not show up when I later put it back on the right way up. The only problem with this procedure is that while it works wonders at home, it is rather difficult to achieve when Lyndall and I are invited out for dinner. Speaking of Lyndall again, one of the many reasons that we have been married for so long, for 33 years. In fact, the publicist added a bit on the press release to say that Lyndall should be canonised for being married to me for 33 years. But one of the reasons we've been married so long is that Lyndall is a woman who isn't the slightest bit interested in illness. I remember years ago saying to her in a self-indulgent way, "I don't feel very well." To which she replied, "Darling, the pyramids were built by people who didn't feel very well." These days, one of life's pleasures is to agree to review whatever books I'm sent, no matter what their scope or subject. Thus, to any reviewing request, my motto is never, never say no, never refuse. It is rather like my tendency never to respond to criticism, a position to which I almost universally adhere. Accepting a random spread of books enables me to read about new and recondite things, to confront difficult and unusual ideas. It's so important to try and keep learning and constantly to explore with curiosity and enthusiasm. Each day I try to follow Sigmund Freud's dictum that the secret to a good life is love and work. So every day I try to contribute, to achieve and to be productive. As my dear friend Antique Harry said, if you aim for the stars, you won't shoot yourself in the foot. After we lived in Brisbane for over a quarter of a century, 2 years ago, Lyndall said, "Darling, I want you to know that I'm going back to Sydney. I'd like you to come with me, she said, but I want you to know that I'm going. As I wanted and still want to stay with Lyndall, the decision was crystal clear, a fait accompli QED. So here we are, living in Redfern, in a terraced house called Greystoke, which, as most of you will know, was the name of the ancestral home of Lord Greystoke, Tarzan of the Apes. One of the many positives of living in Redfern is that it is close to the airport and only a 25-minute walk into the city. Another pleasure is going to Peter the Greek Seafood Cafe in Bourke Street, which sells the best fish and chips in Sydney. And despite my wife's constant objections, I especially enjoy regularly having my hair cut next door to Peter's by Theo the Greek barber, who not only deals with hair on the head, but with recalcitrant hairs in the nose and ears as well. Theo is actually famous or infamous for his very, very short haircuts. What I really like is when Theo puts down his scissors and says, "Will that do?" I pause for a moment and then almost always say, quite deliberately, "I think we need off just a little bit more." Lyndall thinks that no one else has ever said this to Theo. In any case, it certainly produces in my barber what one might best describe as a frisson. Outside Theo's barbershop, there is a large sign facing Bourke Street saying, "Gents Hairdressing, specialising in all styles." I like that. In some way, it describes the way I operate in my mid-60s. Never limit any opportunities or possibilities. Be open and eager for experience. Avoid sloth and self-pity. And above all, be comforted by the fact that, no matter what happens, within a month or two, my hair grows back to normal. As I mentioned, I think Lyndall's revelations about coping with life in her 60s, after having been a well-known Australian model and actor, is one of the funniest contributions to the book. I haven't the time now to detail Lyndall's many suggestions for life improvement, including the multifaceted possibilities potentially available should there ever be travelling Botox clinicians and salespersons knocking door to door. But did you know the vast educational opportunities provided in the first decade of the 21st century by women's panty liners? For everyday freshness, Lyndall uses Libra absorbent liners. As she reveals in her essay, Becoming Invisible, a bonus for the over 50s and over 60s with time on their hands is that inside each Libra liner is a short page of interesting facts. For example, one morning recently, Lyndall learnt that mosquitoes have teeth and are attracted to people who have recently eaten bananas. That American Airlines saved $40,000 in 1987 by eliminating one olive from each salad served in first class. She learnt that Sigmund Freud had a morbid fear of ferns, that cats can hear ultrasound, something I really like, that sugar was added to chewing gum in 1869 by a dentist, William Semple, that licorice can raise your blood pressure, and when the Eiffel Tower was built in 1884, Parisians referred to it as the tragic lamppost. So here's a tip to take home tonight for yourself, your partners, and for all of your friends. To add considerably to one general knowledge, modern-day panty liners, especially the absorbent Libra brand, are highly recommended reading for women and for men, and for their male and female friends and associates who have moved or are moving beyond the big 5-0. So there it is, Growing Old Disgracefully, dedicated to our darling daughter Emily. And thanks for having us, Jared. And as you can see, there are multiple copies of the book for sale afterwards.
Many thanks, Ross. You learn a lot of stuff at the Sydney Institute. That cardigan trick really works in the night, but I often wondered when I have breakfast with Ross why his shirt's always stained in the morning before breakfast, and the reason is he's got his cardigan on the right way, but the stain's on the inside, so it's all very complicated. Margaret Fink I'm going to interview because
She didn't want to give a paper. So here we go. Let's go, Margaret. Now, you're the star here, so I'll just ask a few simple questions. Now, in your introduction, or in the introduction, which I think you wrote, you refer to yourself as having been happily married and divorced with 3 children and 5 grandchildren. Now, do you mean happily married and happily divorced, or happily married and divorced?
Happily married and happily divorced.
Do you want to add to that?
Well, no.
I said it'd be a short no. You start off by saying no matter how decrepit we are, a lot of us think that we have another 20 years to go. I mean, what's the scientific basis for that, and is there any cut-off age?
Well, I think we can ask everybody in the room. But I've been thinking about that myself recently, and I think everybody probably does. Do you think you've got another 20 years to go?
I never thought I did. I actually thought I'd be dead by 21, actually. So
you were
surprised.
Thinking at one? Oh, no,
well,
I see.
From a teenager, yeah.
Okay.
But then you could take a vote.
Now, maybe it's the view of an optimist, but I was born an optimist.
You've got
Go
on.
What?
Go on. You were born an optimist? And
that's enough. Go on.
Your turn.
You've got
a lot of very helpful tips here about fashion and health. You say here, you recommend, you've got a dog named Busy, who no doubt eats one meal a day, as our dog Nancy does, but you're suggesting that humans should also eat one meal a day.
When they're old.
But you say you sometimes only need to throw down health pills. So if you didn't eat the health pills, you'd eat less.
No, I do eat, to have the health pills.
To have the health
pills. You see? Logic. Yeah. But I think one meal a day, I think most people overeat after the age of 50, and certainly a lot overeat before the age of 50, which is evident, sadly. Now, I've got a big thing about diet, and I wanted to do a film about diet reform. And I was gazumped by Mike Murphy, who certainly needs to have one meal a day. Is that his name, Mike Murphy? The filmmaker? What was his name?
Mike Moore.
Mike Moore.
Oh, Mike Moore, yeah. Yeah.
Well, his surname is the key.
I said I wanted to do this with you.
Now, in the book, you never told me that. In the book, Anne Henderson writes a bit about grandchildren, and you write also about grandchildren, and you quote Margaret Mead as saying that the reason grandparents and grandchildren get on so well together is that they have a common enemy. Which is a great line, but would...
I wish it was mine.
So how do you get on with your 3 kids?
Really very well, frankly. So it's just a good line.
Just a good
line. You know how you can't resist those.
I do. Now, fashion sense, you're recommending gloves.
Did I?
Yes, and you're hoping that veils will come back.
Oh, veils, yes.
Yeah, but you recommend gloves, but you don't have any gloves on tonight.
No, I lost them. Well, you know,
it works. And you say that, I don't know what you've got on tonight, but you're saying that a string of pearls really sets things off.
They're in the bank. I've just got back from Sicily.
I think what you're saying that any compliments that come your way that you recall relate to something that... a light around your neck. So you'd recommend pearls? What, for the women?
Oh, no. I mean, I think pearls look good on everybody, especially my friend here, Jerry.
You're against jeans?
Over 40.
And running suits?
On anyone.
I agree with you on that. On one occasion, I think I saw someone at the Sydney Institute in a tracksuit, and I agree with you on that. I post him a copy. Now, we're getting to the end. Someone asked a friend of yours whether she believed in life after death, and she replied that she only believed in death after life. So you're an atheist. But what about the concept of, if you've got 20 years to go, taking out a bit of insurance, because you never quite know. I mean, a fellow member of the Push, insofar that anyone was a member of the Push, Paddy McGuinness, in his
in his dying years moved from being a committed atheist to being a committed agnostic just in case.
Yeah, well, that's Paddy, you know. But Paddy was a big disappointment all round.
That's right.
I thought I'd get in something subversive. Go on.
You're talking about Padraig P. McGuinness AO. Why was he a disappointment throughout?
Oh, well, because he started off thinking clearly and then got befuddled. I mean, somebody... Oh, Keating said that he was a liar and a fraud. And I don't think that Paddy was either of those things. I think Paddy was simply a drunk.
That all?
He was a bright young man. He came into the Newcastle when he was 16 in his Sydney High uniform. And
he never left.
He never left Sydney High. He should have just...
Or the Newcastle.
But a lot of bright... Well, not really.
Figuratively.
Yeah.
So what about the rest of the push?
Well, I mean, it's a big subject, the push in Sydney, because retrospectively it's regarded as something organised, which of course it wasn't. It was just in the 50s in Sydney when I was part of that. Well, it wasn't even a group, really. It was just the most... scintillating and intelligent people in Sydney to mix with. That's all that happened. It wasn't... It's been labelled subsequently. And at that time, we were just the most interesting people in Sydney, which was a smaller society. I think the population was only about 1 million people.
Now, you wrote... Everyone wrote their own introductory comments, which is why they're all so universally favourable, I guess. You wrote that you live with the poet Harry Houghton, who died in 1961.
Mm.
For someone who was brought up in Melbourne, tell us about Harry.
Oh, that's a big story. Harry Houghton was a poet-philosopher, and his time will come, because it takes a long time for the world to catch up with visionaries. And his philosophy, he was a utopian anarchist, and his philosophy has yet to be appreciated by a lot of people. John Kinsella, the poet, is editing a new Penguin anthology of Australian poetry. He got in touch with me recently because he wants to include some of Harry's stuff.
And did Harry leave a great body of work, or did he leave a small body?
Small, yeah. Really.
Yeah. Mm. So some poetry, some philosophy.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, just finally, you talk about... 70 being the new 50, and you...
Oh, but that's a cliché. Look,
but you talk in relation to your dog, which is not a cliché, and you say that Busy, who is 6 and therefore 40-ish, looks no more than 4 and therefore 20-ish. So this is...
I didn't write that. You're saying that.
Well, you wrote, my dog Busy, who is 6 and therefore 40-ish, looks no more than a 4-year-old, or so I tell myself. So you think that this...
1 meal a day. Once you hit middle age. But I mean, when I turned 50, I knew the game was up. Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that was only last week.
Yeah. It only takes a day. It's the day you turn 50, you know the game is up. So anything after that is a bonus, I think.
And you're not going to tell us the answer to the last question, but you're obviously on a project, but you're not... You recommend projects, but I suppose you won't tell us what this project is.
I think you can kill ideas if you talk about them too much before you manifest them. So I'd rather keep shtum on that.
But you're on something.
Developing 2 more films, as a matter of fact.
Well, when they come out, you must come back and talk to us. So thanks for tonight, and now we go to Jerry.
Yeah.
You know you're mortal, I think, Margaret, when you're 30.
What, darling?
I think you know you're mortal when you're 30. And then it's inevitable when you're 15. It's 1 foot... Well, it's not 1 foot in the grave, but I don't believe that life begins at 40 and death begins at 15. Anyway, I've started on a very sour note because I'm not used to talking as myself to grown-ups. I'd just like to take up a point, though, that Margaret, if I can start by warming up by doing someone you know who was an ideological enemy of Paddy McGuinness, and that is, he said, Keating said, what did he say?
He was a liar
and a fraud, but he also used a good word, which was contumely, which he said he got stuck into. He got stuck into people, you know, and used, you know, venom and contumely. Well, I wrote a piece about that for the Fin Review. But I wrote another piece about somebody else which didn't get printed, and that was another liar and a fraud. And get on to this. This is it's not Gerard Henderson, no, but Sir Edmund Hillary. You know, and that is to say, he got stuck into him because 5 minutes out of base camp, he'd give it to him. He'd give it to the Sherpa. You know, his name before the climb was called Tensing. Was called Valium. I blew that gag, didn't I? And after the summit, he had to change his name to Tensing. Because of the contumely that Hillary dished out, you know, this mild kitten that the Sherpa was, became the victim of Hillary, and that is, if you don't know what contumely means, it means pissing on someone from a great height. And if anyone was capable of that, it was Sir Edmund Hillary. Now, ladies and gentlemen, avoidance. I hope that doesn't get into the iPod, into the podcast of this meeting. And if you've just joined us, my name is Gerry Connolly, and avoidance has been the mainstay of my life. I like very much what Ross had to say, particularly about the association of words of an idea, which comes from Barry Humphreys. It's not only Barry's idea of associating a name with a part, a body part, particularly ear becomes chin. What would you call Li Lin chin? Li Lin ear, I suppose. Avoidance has been the mainstay of my life, or at least trying to avoid it. That is life. In God, growing old disgracefully, I willfully avoided the topic and the deadline. And I didn't write or talk about growing old disgracefully. And as there is no specific topic this evening, I find it very difficult to avoid. I don't know why I'm here. I don't know why I'm in the book. I am only 50 years, 4 months and 3 weeks old.
Both of them wanted you there.
I'm the new boy on the block and the youngest contributor to this mess of misery. I contributed to it only because of Ross's persistence, infernal persistence. But I want to say I'm not old. I don't feel old. I don't look old. At least I'm told I don't look old. I've been told I do feel old. But I stand before you with raven hair, only because I went to the hairdresser last week and said I want the darkest dye poured into my mop because I'm going to a senior citizen's do. And now look at me, I'm a cross between Ronald Reagan and Al Grasby. As they are today. As a child, you couldn't have got a meeker, more conforming, higher respecter of authority than me. God, Queen and country, ecclesiastic laws, state laws, municipal laws, dignitaries, governors, officers of any description, I paid due respect. I was bovine-eyed, dimpled, baby-faced, even cherubic. What happened? I don't know. As David Attenborough almost just said then. I play old people. I'm not old, I just play them. From my teens, even before that, in my units, I played oldies. Right across the chessboard. Bishops, knights, queens, rooks. Well, there's no politician on the chessboard, so. And if Robbie Swan would have his way, I could have been a porn star. If anything, I haven't had an adolescence, an adulthood. That's because I've spent my life being old. I don't intend having a second childhood. I'm looking for a first adulthood. I've squandered my life making fun of the aged. And as I stumble, I'm thinking of one of the greatest nonagenarians that I have played over the years, and that is that now Goffy is so old that he doesn't even have to if he can finish his because you all know that the past informs the in the same way that the present informs the So I have used my vast knowledge of the classics to expound on the theory of getting old, as Cicero or once said. He said, "Janu militis fortis, tenere est." Now, for the benefit of those of you who haven't had a classical education, I will translate or construe the text, which means the knee of the brave soldier is tender. Now, all of my critics in subsequent Labour governments, I say this to them, as Cicero said, Quo Vadis. Which means, whither goest thou? Or, as he said in another tract, do you know the way to San Jose? So, in all of this, I simply quote another maxim, sic transit gloria, non vi clementis.
You can clap so I can have a drink of water. And another oldie I did, this year on the 8th of the 8th, 08, it's an auspicious day for whom? It's interactive speech, is it? You just say the last word, that's good. That's what I like to hear. I'm too self-conscious to be up here being didactic, but if you were Dodi and didactic, but it's just... Now I've gone off the track and I'm stuck in a thing. The 8th of the 8th, 08 is an auspicious day for the Chinese, and that's why the Olympics are being opened on that very day. But 40 years ago, this 8th of the 8th, 08 will be the anniversary of this August. Now, I've got to get out of Goffin into me again. It's a very odd gear shift. This August, on the 8th of the 8th, 08, it will be 40 years since Joe Bjelke-Petersen was appointed Premier on the death of Jack Pizzey. Joe could never say a hard Z sound. He said a soft, so he said, "Ah, yes, when Jack Pizzey died, I was given the Premiership, of course." And someone sent me just today, spookily enough, an old quote of Joe's. Excuse me, he was 94 at his death, and this is what he said, not at his death, but when Bob Hawke was Prime Minister, the slogan was, "We should stick together," and Joe was asked what he thought of that, and this is verbatim: "Who wants to stick together with them and get your stick feet? You know, if you get stick foot on sticky paper, you get both of them on, you fall over, and Mr. Hawke asked us to stick with him. You put your foot on sticky paper with him, he's, and Keating, his government's got their feet on sticky paper. My word, they have." I don't have to help, that's just from Hansard, as it were. And... he didn't have to be old to make that much sense. He was disgraceful a lot earlier. Bob Hawke is 78. The Queen is almost 82. You saw Rudd with the Queen after his Bush salute. He stood like a schoolboy, his hands behind his back, a little bit. I don't know what she made of that. But you see, when I grow, now that I've grown old, my mother, of
course, had a croaky, sort of very soft mouth. And that's what's happened to me. My voice has gone down about a fourth, if you're musical, a perfect fourth. And so when I first came to Australia in 1954, it was right up there. And now over the years, it's slowly gone down, and now there's a croak involved. So I hope you'd notice that in the next Christmas message. I know that you all listen to so fervently. More like fun, I suppose. And of course, Margaret Thatcher, who's now 83, and she had vocal lessons as well. When she started, she was much higher and a much more childish resonance, although you could always never be a child with a headmistress tone like that. But I just want to say, when I, now that we have taken the reins and I have been to Buckingham Palace, the Queen has asked me to form government. I want to quote from the prayer of St. Francis. Where there is hatred, may we bring despair. Where there is baldness, may we bring hair. You see, and then over the years, after getting some vocal training, she started to speak not as a soprano or a flute, but as a contralto or a viola or a clarinet, and then eventually as a bass clarinet. Do I make myself clear?
Age is relevant. You know, oh, I used to do all those people, and now the present Prime Minister and I graduated in high school from the same year. He was ducks at the school, and I went on to dress up as an 82-year-old. Queen, and then I went on to do Elizabeth. You see? All the finalists in this year's Archibald Prize are younger than me. Mind you, if I look behind me, there are two generations lurking. The coppers, airline pilots, armed forces, two state premiers now are younger than me. Tony Blair was the first British Prime Minister to be younger than old rocker Mick Jagger. So I'm looking for a new occupation. And you have to have, as Lady Bracknell said, in the importance of being earnest. Mr. Worthing. It might sound a bit like Thatcher, does that matter? Mr. Worthing, I feel bound to tell you that you are not down on my list of eligible young men. Although I have the same list as the dear Duchess of Bolton. We work together, in fact. However, I am quite ready to enter your name should your answers be what a really affectionate mother requires. Do you smoke?
Well, yes, I must admit, I smoke.
I'm glad to hear it. A man should always have an occupation. There are far too many idle men in London as it is.
So I've given up smoking as I was in the final approach to turning 50. The captain said we're about to make our final approach, and so I went off the booze and fags for 9 months, and that's outlined in the book. I don't know how this will affect my workplace in the long run, because once, when I was on stage, I would bargain with myself. I only have to do this, that, and the other, and then I can go out and smoke and drink heavily. I don't miss it particularly, and I'm not a no-smoking Nazi. I don't tut-tut at the desperates outside restaurants and poor unfortunates kicked out of the pub, the we're a dying breed mate mob hanging out around the workplace door. It's just a planet I once inhabited. I achieved escape velocity from it and left. It's a driver-pedestrian thing. Now I am, now I'm not. It wasn't a wise habit to take up, not for a child who'd suffered asthma and rheumatic fever. I'd been a restless, distracted boy, in manic burst with collar in my mouth. I would screech around the house only to collapse exhausted on the bed, recover, and then hit the boards again. Even at rest, it was no rest for the kid. For the weak kid, it should say, and that the pun would be complete. Sleep talking, sleep walking, thumb sucking, bottom scratching, teeth grinding, left no time for dreams or nightmares. And to Robius vermicularis. I'll say that again for the intelligent among you. The Enterobius vermicularis. Oh, that's the cycle of threadworm infestation. It was hard to break in my case because of the thumb sucking and bottom scratching. Sheets were boiled, doses of Vanquin administered, a glove put on the offending paw. And when that failed, a bitter-tasting substance smeared over my thumb, the left, being much scrummier than my right for some reason. Despite all measures, persist it did through the early years of boarding school, though the comfort of the thumb disappeared at age 12. I would grit my teeth and wriggle on the school seat for relief, but it didn't come. Our school nurse, Sister Dory, was tired of it too. I had to provide a specimen which was being sent first to Rockhampton and then, horror, on to a Brisbane specialist to determine exactly what super strain of species inhabited my innards. They just wouldn't die. Could I be infested with the vermi equivalent of the radioactive spider that bit Peter Parker and gave the world Spider-Man? Would I too develop superpowers? Would I be Wonder Woman? It looked like I was doomed, and I would have to wait 30 years until Al Gore raised the profile of global warming. Well, Kathy Lett couldn't be here, so someone has to do the dreadful puns. And my physiotherapist told me yesterday that I've got pain, and this is called the hypochondrium. The Greek for below the cartilage, you see, and now it's become, because people went along with a non-specific, not able to be diagnosed illness or pain, they called it hypochondria. So, you know, we get sick too, so don't hold that against it. Look, I just have to finish because we've got to be out by 10, haven't we? I've got another page to go, but I think I should, there's a beginning, middle and end, I'm sure, but
we can try all three.
Like my life, I don't have an end yet. But I just wanted to say my idea of an occupation in my senior citizenry, my anecdotage, would be to call the time on the phone. I just sit there all the time. At the third stroke, it will be 10, 59 and 10 seconds. Boop. And I could, boop. I could do the pings as well, but or I could go to China with the Rudd. You know, I was there last year or the year before, and I'd like to go around and correct the Chinglish on the Chinese menus. I saw there's one, and the chef special was braised God. I didn't know whether it went praised God or braised dog, but I didn't go into that. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're a greenie or Democrat or Republican, or a Republican or a monarchist or a Lewinskyite, this address, like my life, is almost over. Well, it's not, I've misread that. So far, I don't have an ending, except to say this. The accepted wisdom for any 50-year-old male is threefold. Never go past a toilet, never waste an erection, and never trust a fart.
So, you want to take a risk?
It's not on the podcast, it snapped off. It's only a bit good. Your reputation is intact. Well, I'm not old. I use the computer every day. I text messages with both thumbs.
If you're dealing with Ross, you know, he does say yes to
shut up. And I know who 50 Cent is.
That's why I'm in it. But Ross, how did it all start?
Even what that is and the old money.
Well,
in my piece, I write about
Linda and I both suddenly saw a whole heap of signs of physical and physical decay. And we thought it must be just us. But when we spoke to our friends, they seemed to be going through exactly the same thing. We just asked people that we thought would be interesting. And the only two that turned us down were Barry Humphries and Geraldine Dee.
So we'll take Barry did say a wonderful thing, and then we'll walk out into the night.
Why don't you come up here and say that? Because people are interested.
No, Barry said in an interview in Vanity Fair, I think, the back page, and one of the questions was, what would you change about yourself? And his answer was, my age.
And I think Geraldine Duke said she was busy.
Yeah, she wanted to be in it. She would have liked him in it, but she was too busy.
So there. Up the back. Yes?
Is that me? I'd like to ask the speakers if they can tell me whether it was Oscar Wilde who originally used the term growing old disgracefully. It was, but I'm not absolutely sure.
The consensus is that it was not Oscar Wilde. Yes.
The title of Growing Old Disgracefully is also the motto of the Ulysses Motorcycle Club, a group of ancient bike riders, motorbike riders. So did you ever think about getting a representative of their to write a story in here, and you would have had an even bigger market?
Well, I think they've all gone to Singapore to get the money back from Opus.
Well, it's probably hard to believe, but one of the jobs I do is on the New South Wales Parole Board, and I've indeed come across that motorcycle group. But the title, our title, Growing Old Disgracefully, allows for growing old gracefully. That's why the dis is in, what are those things called? In parentheses.
Brackets. Yeah.
Brackets. Yeah.
Parentheses, of course. Yeah.
I've actually got a serious question for the panel.
Oh, no.
It's from Aussie. It seems like the 50s age group is muscling in on our well-respective exclusive older Australian mantle bestowed on us as a result of our substantial contribution to society. And it seems like this is some desperate grab for recognition by the 50s age group. And I'd like to, they're not really confident, like Margaret said, of having another 20 years left. I'd like a comment from someone.
I think Jerry's got to answer this. I mean, Jerry, what were you doing in the Pacific War? That's the basic
question. That's right. Well, I haven't served my country. Silly old me. Too young for Vietnam and too old for Afghanistan and Iraq, which is a noble and just war. I feel at the tail end of the baby boomers, my older sisters and brother died in the world baby boomers, but anyone born in 1957 is still meant to be included in, what's the cut-off mark, 1960 or 61? Ludicrous. I don't feel 50, and I'm not going to defend anyone in their 50s. Thank you.
Anne, yes.
I want to ask Jerry to expand on what he wrote about panic attacks. Now, apart from your jest about all this, what you write about that is very interesting. I mean, was it really because you suddenly thought you were getting old? Could you describe why you really think it happened?
Well, Anne, I'm not practiced at all at speaking publicly on serious issues. And I can try. It might be a new career, but another war I didn't make. But it's a genetic disposition. Someone who suffers a panic attack, agoraphobia, there can be a number of triggers to these, which are feel like you're dying. The body doesn't know it's not, and so it goes into a hyper state of tachycardia and perspiration, breathing pains, and the feeling of woosiness. And I started these for real in my 40s. In my late 30s. The movie You've Got Mail, I think, with Sigourney Weaver in it, I think that's the title of the movie, depicts a panic attack very well. She She has to leave her building, her apartment, to go outside to get something for the mail. And her trick to quash these or to put them back, to put yourself in control of this kind of thing, is to say the American presidents. And she starts, when the feeling comes on, the dryness in the throat, the feeling of the ominous, the gathering storm, is that she started with Washington and went through. And it's about breath control, focusing, and it's something that is that I've been on medication for 10 years. Now, I haven't spoken about that publicly at all, and I've done it in a light-hearted way in the book. It's a symptom also of depression, which I suffer. I feel like Kylie breaking news on Oprah now. But it goes part and parcel with the capacity to be somebody else, and it's a flaw in the glass, as it were, the underbelly of your capacity to leave the body and inhabit someone else. So if that's enough about that, it's...
Can I ask you about the other attack? I mean, there are two attacks in your chapter. One's the panic attack and the other's the attack by Ian Botham.
Yes.
Well, by or on.
By or on, yes. That was an attack by, yes. I was engaged by the cricket board in 1995, I think, or... 92, thank you. My cricket representative.
You came up from Melbourne.
Thank you. That's a 92, that's right.
I was sitting...
Where were you?
Fairly close to both of them. Maybe.
To both of them or just Ian? This could be a press conference, couldn't it? I'd love to be a politician, but just do wicked comebacks, not talk about fiscal policy. Who is that? Is that... It's not Gooch, is it? No. It was 1992. It was 1992, and I was engaged to play the Queen of England, Australia. Most of the cricketing nations were there. It was World Cup. South Africa had just been allowed back into the fold, and the Commonwealth had been the unifying thing. So I was asked to do it at the exhibition buildings in Melbourne. The first parliament, or the first federal parliament. And I was actually doing Margaret Thatcher when they walked, the two of them, and I thought I'd created an international incident, but not many of the 2,000 people in the building noticed that they had left. And they pretended to be very cheesed off, and I did publicity, international publicity, for 23 hours straight. And it was a lot of fun. But he saw it as an opportunity to... this was on the occasion of his knighthood last year. He revisited that and said he was proud of his country, not like Australia. We're colonial and convicts and have no heritage. And this was he was further affronted by a pouf de gay dressed as the Queen. I suppose that's me. So... someone who had a reputation for trashing hotel rooms and dating extramaritally and putting his foul mouth had been finessed into copping a knighthood from the Queen of England, but not the Queen of Australia.
Here you quote Ian Botham as saying in your chapter, I'm there and I've got some poof de gay guy comes on stage and dragged with a stuffed corgi under his arm and takes the piss out of the Queen.
Stuffed corgi, you know. The fact is, they weren't pissed off. They got they went out, the two of them got a cab, they were laughing their guts out. I know because I got the same cab a couple of weeks later, and he said they weren't pissed off. I took them to a nightclub. They just wanted to get out of a boring dinner, which they did. And... what happened next? I said that on radio, and Botham's manager rang and said, "Now listen here, he's a happily married man. He didn't go out any looking after any floozies." And he said, "Well, I didn't say any of that, but you know." So he's got the knighthood, and I'm just an old 50-year-old.
So I think...
there's one there.
Oh, there's one there. Yeah, okay. We don't want to go on too long. Don't encourage him, Jerry.
No.
Go on. Yeah.
The whole evening has been rather humorous.
How'd you work that?
I almost feel like a killjoy to point out that a large proportion of our population is growing disgracefully old. Because the last few days on TV, there were situations being reported about people who can't even afford to buy meat or put a liter of petrol into the tank. So, what would you say that human could fit into helping these people?
He's been really bad. Go on.
Well, I mean, of course, humour enables us to do sometimes much better what we can't do by speaking directly. The oldest contributor to the book is Hal Alexander, who is a communist to this day from the Erskineville estate. And they're not at all well-off people, but he got very profoundly deaf. And all of the people in the estate who could ill afford it put the hat in and got $3,500 to give him a bionic ear. Obviously, the book can't cope with the problem of homelessness. I mean, youth homelessness is just absolutely appalling. How is it possible in a country like ours to have so many people who are homeless? And as you say, so many elderly people that can't afford proper food. Let's hope Pixie Rudd can do something about that.
I think you're referring to the Honourable Kevin Rudd MP, who's giving our annual lecture next week. We don't want to change that arrangement. So there are 900 people coming, and like Mr. Colony here, I know some lawyers too, you see. Anything else? Any other questions? Do we have... Murray?
I'd like to say that the night has given me great hope for my future. I'm an old duck of 62, being a hairdresser for the last 40-something years, seeing everyday clients that give me a panic attack because they have these ridiculous things like go old, grow old, race with your grey hair and whatever. I'm chuffed to think that you both mentioned your hairdressers. If you all took care in how you look, then you wouldn't feel old because it's all in the mind. So check out the mirror. None of you will feel a day over 50 at any time in your life, and I believe it's all beginning. So stop being grey and acting like old people.
I notice Marie's colour is very similar to Jerry's. You've raised a very...
Just refrain from calling it stuff. I mean, was put down.
What is it called?
May a few streets be appearing there when I see you next time, but that's gorgeous.
Right? It's just down on Circular Quay, isn't it?
So,
the Rocks. The Rocks. Mo's hair at the Rocks. They do mine. Marie does mine. But it's a very important question because Margaret Fink has raised this point in her book, but she doesn't actually quite... agree with you. She actually says, why worry about being bald or spend hours at the hairdressers when putting on a witty hat can do the trick? Turbans are clever ways and scarves can help. Who knows what was under the onesie Stitwell wore. But tonight you're not in your hat. So when do you come hatted and when do you come...
First stop off the plane.
Margaret, can I just ask you what happens when you get home and take the hat off at night? Surely
you think this is a hat?
No. If you are so proud of these hats, yes, as you said in the book, do you want to accept reality or what happens when you actually take off your hat?
Well, it depends where the hat is.
You can't wear the hat to bed. You can't wear the hat.
Oh, yes, you can. Oh, yes.
The Sydney Institute is sponsored by the Hairdressers Association. Yes.
I want Margaret to answer a question seriously.
Margaret, come up here and answer seriously.
Seriously?
When you stand at 50, it's all over. And I totally dispute that. And I think a lot of people find new life at 50. And I want you to think in creative. I think Volga Masters, who wrote all her books. Mary Wesley didn't begin getting published till 70, wrote the most fantastic, right? It has the most fantastic story, which is now in biography. Can you think of things that happen to the creative artists after 50 that don't happen before? I mean, I don't think you really meant it's all over 50, but...
Have you got time for a weekend?
No,
I mean, it'd take a long time.
No,
all I'm saying is that... No, when I turned 50, it was a reality. I really felt depressed. And I, you know, people say you're depressed when you turn 30. And I thought, no, I feel fine. 42. But 50, it was a reality. I felt really down. And I've recovered since then. So, no, I think really health is the thing. I think if you look after your body, that's who you are after all, then you really have got a chance of enjoying life after 50, or 60, or 70, or 80.
Jared, can you tell the audience about you reading The Oldie?
Well, not really, Ross. Oh, I just mentioned the book that when I got to a certain age, I found myself doing unusual things, like the reverse of puberty, and you just found... And I found out I was collecting... obituary notices from the newspapers, and I found out I'd established a file called The Dead where I'd listed all these people, and I found out I was circling, putting circles around their date of birth to work out which ones I'd live longer than, and I found myself subscribing to The Oldie, which is a monthly British magazine which I read every month, and under bright lights, and it has great ads up the back if you really need them. But I did get some heartening out of this. I mean, I think for me, turning 50, turning 60 has just been just terrific to me, because I point out in my chapter that I've always had a terrible problem that since a very young age, don't tell Anne this, for God's sake. It's a bit like Brendan Nelson's listening to her. He keeps saying, "Look, I'm." Don't tell my wife. So what he's sort of really saying is, I want all Australians, I'm listening to all Australians, but don't tell my wife. So don't tell Anne this. But when I got to, from a very young age, I always looked up the would like to meet ads. Would like to meet ads. And I mean, I don't want to be discriminatory, but I was actually looking for the women who were making applications to meet men, not the other way around, although I don't want to be discriminatory. And what happened was, for 30 or 40 years, I never found anything I could ever meet. I could never successfully apply to a woman who was looking for a man. I had, not that I'd want to, but even if I did want to, I couldn't do it because I just didn't qualify. And then I found, very late, I found two great ads, and I mentioned them in the book, which were very heartening, because they, particularly the second one, but not only the second one, because the first one said, if I can find it, I didn't know this question was coming up, and I can't remember all these things now. Yeah, the first one was in The Oldie, actually, and it said, slim, pretty, blonde, age 60, main asset, stunning figure, an own central London flat, seeks gentlemen of substance to enjoy a romantic, mutually rewarding relationship. And I thought, here's a chance, because, and a very good chance, because even if you're not quite up to the stunning figure, the central London flat has certain attractions of my own. But then I got to find the one that I finally found, which was in The Oldie or The Spectator, or one of those ones that has them for certain of a gentle age. And I really felt so, my morale just boosted. It said, silver-haired, 63-year-old, comfortably curved lady, would like to meet kind, ugly, possibly bald gentleman for good conversation and company, and I was really in. It's all in the books. Now, I think we might...
There are books for sale.
Yeah, look, Ross, don't say that.
Don't
okay. There's a question, right? Oh, no, you've had a question. Yeah. Or did you forget that? Sorry, quickly. Okay, we're going to finish it. Yeah.
But at least when you're 60 or 70, you have the advantage of looking wise.
I see. Yes, well, I think that's true. I think that's true. Look, I think we've all had a great night, and someone's got to answer that, so we better stop. If they can hear it. Now, look, thanks to our speakers, Ross Fitzgerald, who edited Growing Old Disgracefully with Lyndall Moore, who's over there and wrote a great essay. thanks to Gerry Connolly for a, can only call it a highly entertaining performance once again. And thanks to Margaret Fing for her wit and wisdom, and thanks for all coming along tonight, and we'll see you next time. Bye.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.